Good morning, everyone. Before I begin, I'd like to take a roll call of everyone that's present. Applin, present. How about Kathleen?
Present.
Foster?
Present.
Tim?
Benjamin?
Yes.
Present.
I'm sorry, I only got one Tim. Kimberly?
Here.
Gilbert?
Here.
So I missed some that aren't highlighted. If you will, just speak up. Who's present?
Natalie Kaler.
Natalie, gotcha.
Abby Frank.
Abby, okay. Who else?
Roel Lopez.
Roel, how are you? There you are.
Dave Scott.
Dave.
Leslie Kinzel.
Leslie Kinzel, hi. Who else are we missing? Okay. We by far and easily have a quorum, so everything is there. So good morning, everyone. This meeting is called to order September 27, 10:01 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, Mr. Estrella has a statement to make.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Andrea Lofi, for the record, Director of your Infrastructure Division at Texas Parks and Wildlife, standing in today for Jason Estrella. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed with the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 of the Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. I'd like to welcome everyone. Thank you for making the effort to come. Do we have any by phone listening in? Okay, everybody here is present. Thank you for the effort and for the wonderful work that's done by this group. So I want to just appreciate everybody and thank them for council members for coming back. Unfortunately, Ms. Kathleen Jackson, our council member from the Water Development Board, was appointed to the PUC. By Governor Abbott. And so I'd like to welcome Kathleen, who is filling her council seat. So welcome.
Thank you.
Action item number two, review and approval of minutes from the October 28, 2021 council meeting, which have already been distributed. I'd like to take a motion for approval, if I can, and a second.
So moved.
Got a motion and a second, I heard, too? Yes?
Second.
Second, I'm sorry. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Briefing item for item number three, ethics review for return and new council members. Ms. Strickler, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, council members and Chairman Applin. Y'all can hear me, right? I'm Theda Strickler, staff attorney for the program, and I am presenting on the Open Meetings Act, the Public Information Act, the Administrative Procedure Act, and other laws relating to the conduct of public officials. Most of you have served on this council before, so you've already heard this presentation. This will be a refresher, but we do have several alternate members attending today, so in an abundance of caution, we'll run through this quickly. First, we're going to talk about the requirements of the Open Meetings Act. That's Texas Government Code Chapter 551. To have this meeting today, it was necessary to comply with that statute. There's a relevant video on the Attorney General's website, which is a requirement for state officials to watch. There are additional resources about the act on that website. One of the key points to remember is that a public posting is required in advance of a meeting with a quorum of council members. The council's actions in a meeting are limited to what's on the posted agenda, and if that law is violated, there are some severe sanctions. The only action item we had for you today was the minutes from the last meeting, which was properly noticed to the public. Moving on to the Public Information Act, which is sometimes called the Open Records Law, and that's Texas Government Code Chapter 552. There's a recommended video online and a certificate showing completion of that video. Just as with the Open Meetings Act, there are other resources available on the Attorney General's website. Key points to remember are that documents within the meaning of this law include any information captured in any form, that includes electronic, recorded, and paper, and any written requests for documents invokes the Public Information Act. Documents are presumed to be public information and must either be disclosed to the requester within 10 business days of the request, or the department must seek exemption from disclosure. The burden is on the state agency to provide there's a valid to prove there's a valid exemption from disclosure, but that is ultimately determined by the Attorney General's office. And these laws are enforceable by criminal and civil sanctions. So our public information officers are Justin Potter and Chris Cadis. Those are attorneys with the department. So they will be your points of contact if you receive a public information request through the council. So the next law we're going to talk about is the Administrative Procedure Act. There are relevant resources available on the Attorney General's website, just as with the other laws. This council does have rulemaking authority, and the department has developed a rule adoption checklist that goes through the steps you'd need to use to adopt a set of rules. When rules are adopted, they're put in the Texas Administrative Code, and then they have the force of law. Thus far, the council has not seen the need to adopt formal rules, and staff does not have any recommendations to do so at this time, but it's a possibility if it's ever needed. The act also addresses contested case hearings where a body of state officials serves as a judicial body in a judicial capacity, but that won't happen for this council. So next, we're going to touch on other laws governing conduct by public officials, specifically on ethics, dealing with lobbyists, and grant making and contracting. So for ethics, here are a few of the most important ethics laws to be aware of. Some of the revolving door restrictions have been updated, so when you get close to the end of your term, you might want to take a look at those. An important task for each of you will be to complete a personal financial statement by April 30th of each year. There are details of how to do that on the Texas Ethics Commission website. So generally speaking, conflicts of interest are prohibited. A council member must not vote on or otherwise participate in a matter in which they have a conflict of interest. If that situation arises, you should note on the record that you have a conflict and publicly recuse yourself from a decision in that matter. So, dealings with lobbyists. Lobbyists are sort of a special category of interaction under the ethics laws. Given the nature of this council, it's unlikely that you'll have significant dealings with lobbyists, but there are special rules for state officials dealing with lobbyists. Those are in Texas Government Code Chapter 305. Gifts that are otherwise permissible under bribery laws and other ethics policies might not be permissible if they're coming from a registered lobbyist. There's a list of registered lobbyists on the Texas Ethics Commission website, and it's important to know that even if a gift from a lobbyist is permissible and you can accept it, your name will appear on that lobbyist's activities report if certain thresholds are reached. This council will issue grants to applicants, so it's important that we follow all contracting and grant making laws to prevent favoritism or the appearance of favoritism. Staff at the department will monitor and supervise the grants and contracts to make sure that all requirements are met. The department is subject to ethics rules applicable to contracting when it carries out this program, and the council should at least be aware of those rules. There is a helpful video on the comptroller's website. There is additional guidance in the State of Texas Procurement Manual and the Contract Management Guide. Department staff follows those guidances, but it's important for you to at least be aware of them. So for those of you who are not state employees, we'll touch on a few miscellaneous points. State property can only be used for state purposes. This council may be reimbursed for travel expenses, but reimbursement is not allowed for alcoholic beverages. State funds cannot be used to influence the passage or defeat of legislation. The council, when it was administered by the GLO, didn't adopt policies prior to January 1st, 2016, and the council has not adopted any since it's moved here to the department. The Texas Ethics Commission website has helpful information on ethics policies, including helpful hints for filing your personal financial statement, and a document about the thresholds for accepting gifts or meals from outside persons when you are doing your duties as a member of the council. That's all I have. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Strickler. Questions, anybody from the council? None? Okay, thank you. Briefing item number four is the status of Texas Farm and Ranch Lands Conservation Program is existing projects. Mr. Abernathy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
We have a full house today. How about that? For the record, my name is Chris Abernathy, the program coordinator. I also have a little bit of training that I have to conduct, just like Ms. Strickler did, and then we'll do the program status update. So I have to give a little bit of training on the program history, the background, as per the statute. As you all know, and we've said it a few times, the program originally started in 2005 with the General Land Office, and in 2015, House Bill 1925 brought the program over to Texas Parks and Wildlife, and in that they did a few things. They literally created the transfer of the program from GLO to TPWD and gave us a $2 million appropriation per biennium. They created the council that you sit in today. They created the criteria for awarding grants, and they created the council and the conservation fund, which is the money that we use to fund those conservation easements. It also provided, you have a role of program oversight. You also get to, like you did last year, you get to select the applicants that we submit to you for grant applications to receive awards. You authorize us to enter into grant agreements with those landowners and those land trusts to get those acquisitions. You also, as Ms. Strickler implied, you have the ability to adopt rules. You just have not yet done that to this date. You also have the ability to accept outside funds. We haven't been really successful with outside funds, but we're always hoping that we could find some exterior funds that would help with this program. And you also have the ability to create a fee and a service cost for anything related to this program. Again, you have not done that to date. The program mission, you all know the program mission. We are here solely to purchase conservation easements on working lands. That's our goal, is to protect habitat, species, water quality, watershed, conservation, open space, dark skies. We do it all with our program. Some people don't always know what working lands mean. Those are privately held farmland, ranchland, timberlands, and anything managed for wildlife, which is usually synonymous. And we also, our highest priority, as you guys know, is the threat of development. I live in Comal County, the fastest growing county, maybe in the nation, certainly the fastest growing county in Texas. We need to protect some open space there, just as all the other metropolis areas as well. That's it. That was very quick. I apologize. I'm very fast. 10 minutes ago, we didn't have a quorum, so I'm still, my blood pressure is still up. But thank you all again for coming. Okay, so this is where we are right now. These are projects that are closed or are still in process. The green dots are the current funding cycle we're in right now. But you can see we have a really pretty good concentration of properties, obviously centered around the Hill Country area. We have several properties along the coast. But if you look out west, we've got one that's already established on the border of New Mexico and Texas. We've got the Miller property out there, I think near Valentine. We've got some on the Red River. So we're doing pretty well. I'd like to see some in the Panhandle. Maybe that'll happen next time. But I would eventually like to see a better distribution across the state. So we've had four funding cycles to date. And remember, we're talking about biennials, so 2-year periods. I put them down there just for my own convenience. We did it in 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 23. And we're in the 22-23 funding cycle right now. I currently have 22 properties that have closed, so I have everything, and I have 6 more that are in process. I will say that we had originally 9 properties that were through the application process that you all approved last year, one has been closed and two have withdrawn from our program. So the funds are dedicated to those with program or those projects that withdrew will be reappropriated to other projects that are still currently open. I have several projects that need more additional funds. We're going to take those additional funds and make sure that they do not revert because we cannot lose any funding. Again, as of right now, about 28,000 acres that we've taken care of just in the last 5 years, and we're going to get almost another 15,000 by the end of next fiscal year, by the end of August of next year. So we'll have, you know, several thousand acres that will be under protection. And our money. So this is strictly for acquisition. If you guys remember, we, on our grant agreements, we pay for due diligence, which are things like appraisals, surveys, background reports, any of the project management that takes place by the funding or by the land trust, but those are just for the acquisition of funds. So $6.4 million out of the conservation fund since the project started. We've gotten $19 million from the Fed. Almost 100% has been from the NRCS, but we do have some from the RCCP. And in matching funds, $6.3 million in matching funds, which is really great. So we have total spent to date is $32 million. This is where you're going to see our where we get our leverage. So out of that $32 million, we have $55 million worth of appraised conserved properties. And that's a regular appraisal, just like anybody else would get. If you took the conservation value and divided it to the state funds that we have spent, we're getting 8.6-to-1 ratio on our dollar for conservation value. That's pretty good odds right there. We spend only $147 per acre out of our funding alone. Again, really, really frugal. And the total cost per acre, still under $1,767 per acre when you combine all the funds. And let's talk about this application process for next year. So, again, this is an off year. Next year we'll start the application process in March. I usually leave it open for about 60 days. I usually announce to all the land trusts that we're having an open call for applications, and all my land trusts are really good about knowing when this is happening and they get everything submitted in time. Internally, we do an internal review of all the subject matter experts. We look at every single project application, weigh its merits, and then we literally rank them. And those rankings are brought to you in September. In the interim, the ones that we rank put on our short list, those are the ones that we send out wildlife biologists and botanists and everybody else, and they go out on those properties and they verify that those resources that they talk about protecting are there, the water, the plants, the wildlife. And then in September, we bring those applications to you and we ask you that you select those and authorize us to enter into contracts with them. Once our September meeting will be done next year, we'll do our grant agreements, working with contracting internally, and hopefully by November or December of next year, all the new land trusts and all the applications, those projects will hit the hit the ground running, and they'll go through another two-year cycle. And that's it. So I know I go really fast, so if there's any questions, please. Yes, ma'am.
You told us that there are going to be some funds that are reallocated to open projects. At what point will we be advised of
the So in the end of last year, when we had our September meeting, you essentially gave us authority to expend those funds for projects that may have fallen out. I don't believe I need another formal action to do that.
Right. I'm just wondering if we'll be told in, like, the general report next year.
Oh, most definitely. And I can certainly keep the council up to date as those happen. So I'm really been trying to get the council meeting out of my way, but we already have requests for those funds. So as soon as I knew those funds were, like, you know, going to be freed up or unencumbered, I have one called Albritton, and they need some extra funds, and the other one is the Burleson property. Both of those properties appraise it significantly higher than what the original estimate was, and that always causes an issue with us. It always causes a loss of funds, and so I have no problem reappropriating those funds, none whatsoever. I mean, people are really hungry for those monies, and so we just do the best that we can.
Great.
But I am afraid, you know, we have no money. Our money does not stay in our fund. It reverts back. And so I have to spend that within the legislature.
No, we want you to.
Yes, ma'am. Anything else?
Anyone else?
I have a question. Your criteria that you use to submit projects to the council, how does the proximity, you mentioned Comal County, but proximity to likely development weigh in along with all the other issues of wildlife, habitat, those things?
The threat of development, sir, is our number one criteria. It counts for 30 points out of 100. Is
30
the threat
out
of 100,
okay.
Yes, sir. And then, I don't remember them all in a specific order, but then we look at, again, water quality, habitat, wildlife, watershed, the use of best management practices. There's several criteria that
Does this council have the ability to adjust the criteria schedule?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they do. In fact, they did about 3 years ago. What was happening is that certain of the land trusts felt that our program wasn't sticking to its original foundation of looking at working lands versus maybe those that were just dedicated to wildlife or enhancement or something like that. They really wanted us to target those. So I couldn't change the criteria, but with the help of the council, we adjusted that point system, and we gave more weight to the threat, and we took a little bit of weight off of some of the other criteria.
Good. That allows you to, this council, to make changes as things evolve. So good.
Yes, sir, and you are welcome. I mean, we could have that as an action item next year if you would like to look at the criteria again, revisit the criteria.
No, I put complete confidence in the county. I mean, I'd like to just, for curiosity, but I don't question the council's allocation. I just was curious, and I'm glad that proximity or likelihood of development is the number one.
It is definitely the number one. We have a property right now on Mustang Island. Anybody that's been to Port Aransas in the last few months knows what driving to Port A looks like coming out of Corpus. I go there a lot myself. And the threat of development is really high, and we were able to protect, I think, I don't even remember how many acres, but we were able to protect a good size of space right there on Mustang, near Mustang Island.
Good. Thank you for your presentation.
And if you are interested, Mr. Chairman, I have what we call an annotated version of the criteria. It explains why we made the changes, what our thought process was, and what we were looking for. So that's available online for any of our land trusts as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Briefing item number five, a landowner perspective. Mr. Krause, thank you for appearing before the council. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I've been asked to... as a landowner, kind of tell my story, my experience, and describe my land, which did get a conservation easement. I'm one of the 20 that was mentioned before, and show you a few slides of my property. So that's okay with you?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I think I really want to start from the beginning, because after leaving my grandparents' loving touch for the first 3 years, I moved back in with my parents for 3 years. My dad was an ag agent, a Farmers Home Administration agent for the USDA people here, and he'd gotten an assignment in Jordanton. So we lived on a ranch out there, and it was time for me to get outside in my own backyard so I could get out in the fields and run around. There was a boy on the ranch next door my age, so the next 3 years were just perfect. After that, we moved to San Saba when I was 6 years old, and he took a position there. And when I saw the hill country, I just fell in love with it. I mean, this was the first place I could climb a tree that didn't have thorns. And in the Rio Grande Valley, stay away from the canals, they're water moccasins. And at the ranch in South Texas, stay away from the stock pond, they're water moccasins. But San Saba River was so clear and clean, I could see everything in it and stay away from any dangers. And I couldn't swim, but that little fragile stream, I could get all the way across it, mostly on my tippy toes, a little dog paddling, and I could swim across the river. I loved San Saba. Now, the only problem was I thought it was being published because we lived not on a ranch, but we lived in town. And I was really disappointed about this, but my parents, I now understand later, sacrificed their preferred lifestyle in order that I might be able to live in a neighborhood, ride my bike to school instead of a bus, maybe be, you know, hope that I might turn out a little bit normal. So, but I still felt punished living in town. My dad understood that. And there were times when he would come by and pick me up after school and take me to his last call that he was going to. And I got to see a ranch. And sometimes I got in pretty heated discussions out there. And I do remember my dad calling me over from time to time and saying, because when my little boy grows up, I want him to see a ranch as beautiful as yours. It always seemed to calm things down. So we went from there. I think I better back up a second. I became a pain in the butt because every day my dad came home from work, I go, Daddy, Daddy, you're going to take me to a ranch today? And the answer was no, not today. And then as a 6-7-year-old, you know what my answer was, is why? And he said, because we can't go to a ranch anytime we want to. You have to own a ranch to go anytime you want to. And I got so mad, I said, well, that's it. When I grow up, I'm going to buy my own ranch so I can go to it every day. Well, my parents had friends over for coffee and Domino's and things that parents do. They would call me in there and say, Gary, what are you going to do when you grow up? I said, I'm going to buy my own ranch so I can go to it anytime I want to. And they would burst out in laughter. And I just didn't understand parents' sense of humor, adult sense of humor, I guess. I'd walk away. And for Dr. Lopez, the other thing that I would hear him say about me is that not only that, the kid here in the neighborhood comes home from college at UT. He's a geology major, and he takes Gary out on to do some rock hunting. And so now he wants to go to UT and be a geologist. And I went, oh. And he said, I tried to explain to him that when I went to college, I went to A&M and studied agriculture. And back then, they didn't allow women at A&M. But, you know, so maybe by the time you're ready to go for college, they'll allow men at UT. And everybody would laugh at that, too. But I never understood that until actually probably my college years.
Oh, brother.
So then from there, we went to Temple for 3 years, state office, and organized baseball. You know, I had just the most ideal upbringing. And when I was ready to explore the larger world, I started to understand things like Vietnam and everything that was happening in the big, larger world around me. We moved to Washington, D.C. And my parents didn't want to go, but the president we had in the mid-60s kind of had given a direct order, and he was somebody that didn't take no for an answer. So we moved to Washington, D.C. And I lived there through junior high, high school, and college. And I'm proud of my dad. And for those of you that are with USDA, he was Bill Krause. And he became the director of the FHA. So I'm in Maryland. I'm getting further away from my hopes and dreams. But I always held on to that. I always wanted it. It was still always there. And I remember my senior year of college, I was at my parents' house, and it was snowy and icy, and we were kind of stuck indoors. And my mother was a painter, so I went downstairs, and the only painting I've ever done, and it was pretty crude, I admit, my first and only effort. But I painted my vision of my ranch. And I wrote on the back of the land I'll buy someday. And it's in my living room now. So the plan then became move back to Texas, start my business so I could make enough money because I wouldn't make enough working for somebody else so that I could work real hard and when I turned 30 have $1 million to go buy a ranch. I did 2 out of 3. I worked real hard and I turned 30. And I had a friend that I met because we wrote music together. We wrote songs together. And he was the real songwriter, but he wasn't a lyricist, so I had to help him out. And I found out, when he found out my dream, he said, well, I'm from San Antonio, and I've got a real estate license. And I said, I thought you were a songwriter. He goes, songwriters have to have a second job, buddy. So I said, I'll take you out to the Hill Country and take you around. I'll take you to San Saba and, you know, show you around. We looked at I don't know how many places over about a three-week period. And no, what don't you like about it? I would tell him. And by telling him everything I didn't like about everything I saw, he said, I know exactly what you're looking for, but you can't get it. And I said, well, if you know what I'm looking for, even if I can't get it, can you show it to me so I know we're on track? And he said, yeah, but you can't get it. So don't get your hopes up. So he took me to this piece of property. And I was in awe of the beauty of this area, north of Lakey on the west fork of the Prio. And we drove through because out of Lakey, north and south, it is nothing but subdivisions and houses every 150 feet. It's a mess. But we drove into this area, and we were driving through a subdivision. And we got into this remote area. It was just gorgeous. I kept thinking, this is it. And then we came to the entrance, and my God, I found my land. And when you turned into the land to cross the river at the natural ford, there was a sea of daisies that were 6 feet tall, just a sea of them in the floodplain. So it went through these golden gates to go in. And found out later these things are called swamp daisies. That's not a very romantic name, swamp daisies. But my wife and I, for romantic reasons that I cannot disclose, renamed those September 27th flowers. So on September 27th, I think it's appropriate that I at least say that. When I get home tonight, I'm probably going to break a law, but I'm going to cut a bouquet and take it in the house. So we went into this land, this beautiful bottom land filled with hardwoods, went up on the hill, went up on top of the hill, and then looking down at the river below, I swear, this is the painting hanging on my wall. So I had to get it. But I couldn't. And the problem was that this was a part of a subdivision, and the developer had bought it on a floating interest note and had sold about 80% of the ranch on fixed interest notes at 7%. In 1979, the interest he was paying went up to 24%, and he went bankrupt. So the whole thing reverted back to the rancher that he had, or the ranch owner that he had bought it from, the developer bought it from. And he was mad as heck. He said, I buy and sell ranches and I'm in the oil business. I don't need to be in the land sales business and collecting money from all these people. And it just sat there in bankruptcy proceedings and everything. And so for a couple of years, it just sat completely dormant. Nothing was happening. More than a couple of years, actually. So I've always thought that, okay, everybody told me I can't do it, but everything else I've done so far, everybody told me I couldn't do. And there must be an opportunity there. So I found out the people, and I talked to them and talked to them, and I said, let me help you solve your problem. You've got some unsold property. You need to get it sold. And he goes, yeah, well, I've got to hire the broker that sold it has now in charge of it. He goes, I've hired a woman that's going to take over the accounts, and I'm going to get set up to sell the rest of the property. And I said, well, I'll buy as much of it as I can from you. And he goes, well, I'll give you first shot. And I said, I'll do something better than that. My wife has a real estate license. We'll help you sell the rest of it. So I became the answer to his problem. He goes, okay, well, we'll work it out. So it gave me time. There was hope. I thought it was going to happen. So I had to explore along the river a little bit in this area that I knew I was going to get. And it just kept getting more and more beautiful. And this is looking downstream from the earlier one. It's got, you know, this area that hadn't been sold was over a mile of river, had about three big holes that were easily, you know, 200 yards or longer that you could swim in, some holes over your head. A lot of the rest of it was rapids and stuff. But you see that hill beyond, underneath that hill lay my pot of gold. I found it. So, still didn't have any money, but I had time to figure it out and earn some. And so my first purchase, I worked out a deal where I bought a few of these lots, but committed to X others, and they would let me buy them at least 100 acres a year times 3 years, each one of them on a 15-year note at 10% interest, that I'd be able to make the down payment. I would just work hard enough to make the down payment and keep up the payments. And I even went out on a limb further, and I said, I don't have enough money. When it finally came available, I said, I don't have enough money to get the first 100 acres to put down on it. But if you let me start making the land payments, in 6 months, if I haven't raised the down payment, then I'll give it up. That's what I did, and I got the first 100 acres, which happened to be the along the river there, and is a mile of river. They gave me a topo map of the unsold land, and I had a chance to explore the rest of the river. Now, this view of the bluff above the river is actually taken from my front porch. And I started exploring along the river and finding all kinds of things. And it took a Texas Parks and Wildlife geologist that was out there visiting to explain to me that those were nothing but dinosaur tracks on the land in front of my house. And there are a few that are well-preserved. There are some that were ground down to nothing by wonderful county trying to smooth out the road on their easement. But there were a lot of other wonders in this area. And looking a little closer at this bluff, the lighting here is able to show that you see the more beige limestone above and the darker grayish limestone below. And since it's winter, you can see them. There are springs come out of that cliff. So what I did is I took this topographical map that was overlaid on the tracks that were available for sale. And I found the level of those springs, and I followed on the topographical map that level as it meandered through all of the available tracks. And I found springs at that level everywhere I went. But I found springs, and man, did I find springs. Found some of the most incredible springs. And problem was, there was 150 acres or so between the river property and these springs. So in order to get them, I really had to commit to buy a lot more land. But I did. And I got them connected. In so doing, I learned in the process how everybody hates subdividers. And but by doing this, I eventually combined about 16 different tracts that would have been sold to other people. So they thought it would be more of a consolidator than a subdivider after that, and the ranchers started accepting me a lot more. But these springs, after I acquired them, I named them Church Springs. I don't think I have to tell you why. And so I ran that ranch for a while, and I could see across my fence some more land. And, you know, there's a kind of a joke about Texas ranchers, that they don't want all of the land in Texas, they just want all the land next to them. And I kind of got a little bit of that disease. I didn't want all the land next to me, just all the land that I could see. And so when I looked out in the distance, I saw some beautiful land out there in the distance, the ranch next to me. And the foreman of the ranch was a really good guy, and I helped him a lot with work. And he introduced me to the owner, and I told her that if I could ever afford it one day, and if she'd be willing to sell it to me, that I would be interested in buying it. Well, it became a negotiation, and I talked to that woman for 10 years, and one day I got a surprise, and it was like the dog that finally caught the car. I got an offer. She offered to sell it to me, and once again, I was broke, and what am I going to do? So I bought as much time as I could and worked as hard as I could to raise money. I took a stack of credit cards that weren't used and cashed out everything I could on them. I went to clients that I was doing seminars for, and I said that the ones that I'd been working for years, I said, if you'll put the money up now for your one-half deposit like you always do for next year's programs, when the time comes, I'll do those programs for half price, for no additional cost. I did everything I could to raise the money, and I finally bought that land. Turns out that all the land I could see was two pastures, because the fence was on the ridgeline. So it looked great from a distance, and you got to get a little closer. That tail end of that bluff is called Yellow Bluff, and if those of you that have been north of Lakey and know where the HEB camp is on 83, you're up on the plateau, and if you're going towards Lakey, it drops down into a really severe drop-off and curves. Well, the old wagon road from Kerrville to Lakey came up the Guadalupe to the top of that hogback and down close to where the HEB camp is, and they were told to look west until they could see the Yellow Bluff. And from 83, when they could see the Yellow Bluff, take that canyon down, follow that creek down to the river. And so that was the wagon trail, and it goes right through what is now my ranch. So that's the old wagon trail, just a shot of it. And seeing that wagon trail, it suddenly dawned on me, I know now why they call that a buckboard that they sat on these wagons coming through these hills. But it would go down to the river and then on down to Lakey. So looking deeper, I found, you know, you got to get the closer and closer you get to the land, the more you find the beauty. There were seeps everywhere in this place, and the more cedar we cut, the more seeps we have. And it doesn't look like a lot of water in the summer. All you see is a lot of maidenhair fern. But there's actually a heck of a lot of water that comes out of these. And I'm talking miles of bluff and creekside where all you see is maidenhair fern. And if you get close, you can maybe hear some dripping. But in the winter, after a freeze, you can see really how much water is coming out of these. So with permission or apologies to Texas Parks and Wildlife, I showed a non-native species. The non-native species have to be managed, and they are on my place. It's a low ranch, low fence ranch, and so therefore it's part of life. But even though this is a non-native species, I think it really shows the importance of protecting the land and protecting the springs, because they're fragile. And these fragile little springs and fragile little spring holes are what protect or provide a life for all of the animals that are on the ranch. These little seeps become creeks, small at first. They get bigger, they get deeper. They surveyed out as part of the conservation easement on the ranch, on my 1,640-acre ranch, either within the ranch as creeks or on the boundaries as creeks and rivers, 5 miles of running water on my ranch in 1,640 acres. So one of the things as you look closer is geologically significant and conservation significant area, double sinkhole, as is explained to me by Texas Parks and Wildlife formation, where there's a pool up at the top, about a 10 feet drop down to the water level, and then the water level is about 12 feet deep after that, and there is a bottom. It's a pool. That pool spills over into the next sinkhole. The next sinkhole is bottomless, and it's legendary bottomless well. Dan Ault, second generation owner of the ranch, was also an oil man, and he hired divers to go down there to find the bottom of it. And they said it went to a crevice that they couldn't get through, but they could tell that it went much deeper, but they couldn't get through it. So then hired a spool truck that came out and exhausted the line and never found the bottom of it. So it obviously goes into an underground cavern. Now, at Church Springs and this one, we now know that those are two points on the property that access the aquifer, because those are the two areas from which, expanding in the creeks, we find an unclassified salamander. So that's sort of the proof of the theory. And so this is on the property, and it's quite a hike to get down to it to see. But it's one of the areas that I'm protecting with this easement. Now, I don't even really know what I am going to show next, except I do want to tell you that when I found this property in the beginning, I knew that it was special. I knew that it was more than just the ranch that I was going to buy. I knew that it had to be protected. I contacted the Nature Conservancy. I contacted the Audubon Society. I contacted the Isaac Walton League. I started asking around, who else can I contact? Who can I help? Who can I find that can help me protect this forever? And everyone that I talked to said, well, do you own it free and clear? And I said, no, not yet. I said, don't want to talk to you. So really, from the moment I bought this, I got on those train tracks, and that freight train has been coming behind me till I got it paid off. When I got it paid off, I renewed the effort. I finally retired when I had enough money to have everything paid off and some set aside so that we could build a house on the property. And it still wasn't easy. And my good friend Guy Louie, who was always my cheerleader and picking me up and saying, you got to keep trying, you got to keep trying. Somebody out there will do this. And speaking of Sky, when Claude Ross was out there seeing the land and inspecting it through this process, when he saw the fence line He took that as a teaching opportunity for all of the NRCS people that were with him and said, the beauty of this piece of property, while we really need to protect it, is that this is one entire drainage system. And Sky Louie would turn over in her grave because, in her words, that's a catchment system, and that's part of the reasons why we're able to have all the springs on the land. But at any rate, I struggled through these years to get this done, to get the easement in place. And after open heart surgery, two surgeries actually, and multiple times on the bed for other treatments, I stayed alive long enough, and I still wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. I didn't have the resources. The kind of money that Texas Parks and Wildlife put up to help make this happen, the organization and overseeing that Dave Bazanson and the Nature Conservancy did for me, and the money that the NRCS put up, was the only way this was ever going to happen. It just wouldn't have happened. But it's a conservation easement now. This is that upper hole. I really forgot what slides I had next, but they're worth looking at, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
That one's fun to jump into. First time I took Gwen there, I won't tell you the whole story, but I made her jump in. And, I will tell you, I threw her clothes down on the very bottom, and I made her jump in. And then we swam over to the edge, and we jumped down to the next one. Now, I do want to tell you that she's a brave woman because I was afraid, but we did it. We took the leap together. When you're looking down, I don't know, it's probably 20 feet at that hole, knowing that it's 1 foot deep on the sides, it looks like a little postage stamp. But we jumped down in there and then took our walk through the creek. But you can see the fish in it. There's all kinds of interesting fish life in there. We've got, you know, the people that David works with in Texas Parks and Wildlife have identified bullnose minnows and that other one. What was it, David? But headwater catfish. I think it's important to note that. And we have tested the water, but as that water leaves my ranch, it dies. It dies very, very quickly. And a couple miles below my ranch, for the last 15 years, the West Fork has gone dry. It's just dry down there. But up where I am, it's constantly flowing, and we're feeding the Frio River. That one spring, Church Springs, was studied by Texas Parks and Wildlife guy, what's his name? Chad Norris, with many years ago. He started 15, 16, 17 years ago, he started studies on there. And he measured it at 4.58 cubic feet per second or something like that. And I said, that means nothing to me. Can you translate to gallons per minute? And it was like 1,962 gallons per minute or something. So I did the math. You can check it for me. But 1 minute times 60 times 24 times 365, it's over a billion gallons of water a year that we're putting into the Frio. So we need more places like this. But when you leave my ranch, it is nothing but development, all the way down to Lakey, all the way down to Concan. Got to stop somewhere. So that's my ranch. That's Krause Ranch. That's what this weird thing turns out to be. And all I can say is that this particular ranch would not be in an easement, would not be protected, if I really didn't have the help that I got from you guys. So I'd like to speak as a landowner to other landowners, not as a salesman. If anybody has an opportunity, or if anybody knows the landowner that's considering an easement, have them call me. let's talk. I can tell them the benefits. I'm not trying to sell them anything, but I sure hope we can find more ranchers that want to do this. Any questions? Thank you for your time.
Gary, thank you. It's an incredible story. It's clear the passion you have for these properties, for your ranch, and for the conservation in the state of Texas. So thank you so much. It exudes from you the passion.
Thank you, sir.
Wonderful story. It's a beautiful piece of property. I don't know if anybody on the council got to take a field trip, but that would be incredible to go see. Did some of y'all get to go see it? Maybe you could invite a few.
You have a formal invitation right now.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, members, any other questions or comments? We're going to move on to briefing of item number 6, impacts of lost working lands in Texas. Chad, please make your presentation. How are you?
Doing well, Chairman. Chris asked me to come speak, and when I always have the opportunity to come speak about things that I love, and I know where I stand on Chris's after having to follow Gary, but we'll do it and kind of talk about it. And I think Gary's, I mean, actually it couldn't have been any better. You know, you articulated, right, what Texas is about and what Texans are and the passion that we have. You know, a lot of you know me in this room of the two things that motivate me and inspire me. And I'm extremely passionate about our lands and what they provide to all Texans. The first thing is really what motivates me is about the relationship of people to people. Right, it's about what we have and what we hear, and getting to meet people like Gary in that aspect. And the second is really the relationship of people to the land, and we just heard that from Gary, of really what that means, and the, you know, the great responsibility we all have of taking care of the land and keeping the land intact and providing all of these ecosystem services that we talk about. And you know, so I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about keeping Texas, Texas, right, and that aspect and what we're losing, and kind of through an additive conservation when I talk about how we stack these things. You know, so it's really about how do we keep Texas, Texas? How do we keep that lover, that passion? And I utilize that word. I mean, Gary talked about this intimate relationship of the land, right? And if we start thinking about it, we all have that. That is actually an ecosystem service, right? That's a mental health, a physical health that we gain, right? It's a it's a benefit that we gain from that land. And so I want to keep that in our mind as we kind of talk through this presentation real quick. But I want to do something real quick before we go, and it kind of comes on to what Gary was talking about. So I'm going to talk through Texas Ag Land Trust and through our lens. So we heard from a producer's lens. I'm going to talk from a land trust lens. Texas Ag Land Trust, we've helped empower 38 families like Gary. And that's what it's about. The second part, we've put conservation easements over 270,000 acres across the state, which is pretty amazing. So I want everybody to get a pen out and think about ecosystem services and what we've done. Of just TALT, that's just one land trust. We got David with TNC, and we have, you know, 30 other land trusts. And we think about conservation easements. That 270,000 acres that we have across the state of Texas, I want everybody to think about how many of that conservation, of those 270,000 acres, How much water conservation did those acres provide? How many water bottles could it fill? Am I clear? The water conserved on those 270,000 acres, how many of these water bottles is protected of those land stewards like Gary on an annual basis. So I want everybody to put that number down, take a guess of what that is, and our closest folks will get a TALT cap. And so we'll come back to that. So as we move kind of further into it, how many of you read the Wall Street Journal? This was came, I think, 2 days ago, if I remember, Beaver. I don't know if you saw this one, but this one kind of says the U.S. is running short of land for housing, right? It's a different perspective. It's a perspective of this story is about in Florida and outside Tampa, and I always read a lot of those comments in these stories, and you start reading the comments of the stories, and people are like, oh, we got land. It's all over. It doesn't matter, right? So it's just something to think about that not all of us have the same vision or understanding and passion up to the land, and we're getting further and further disconnected, right, of some of those stories. And so I put that in there to, for us to kind of think through that that aspect, that these are true pressures as we're moving. So what do we see here? What do we see in this picture? This landscape, kind of hill country. What does everybody see? Romy, what do you see?
Beautiful sunrise.
All right, sunrise. Gilly, what about you?
I see cattle grazing.
There you go. All right. That's my boy right there. So really what we have here is a dynamic ecological system, right? There's multiple ecological cycles. They're all competing for balance, right? We have the sunlight, that's the energy cycle. We have the mineral cycle. We have the water cycle that we heard Gary, right? And they're all competing. And that's what our landscape, it's very dynamic. But for every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and it's wrong, right? And so this is what we have. But more importantly, the answer is truly right, literally staring at us, right? It's more than two-thirds of the land in our state that we love so much is privately owned, 141 acres. So the opportunity really knocks for us to help keep that in mind. But we have to change the paradigm of our ecosystem services, right? They don't just occur. It takes land stewards like Gary, as we heard, to keep providing that private land stewardship equals those public benefits, all of those things. It takes that aspect. It also takes our public land stewardship, right, of the resources of our state parks or our wildlife management areas. And it's us talking and going back and really articulating all of these benefits. We talk about just hunting and recreation and water, and we kind of stop the conversation, right? And there's so much more, and we'll talk about kind of the conservation value of Chris talked about of the return on investment for this committee, and it's underestimated, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that aspect. But one of the components is and I can get on my soapbox really quick on this, is ecological problems are resolved by principles, not practices, right? And unfortunately, from our model, we want to put an X practice, right? We want to put a practice on there, and that's going to treat it. And it's really about the systems approach of putting a suite of practices and truly managing those properties as a whole. So a lot of times our conservation model is about really giving fish and not really teaching landowners or land stewards how to fish. And these are some of our dynamics that we have to think about as we move into this aspect. So really, what the key is really developing a drive, right, of land stewardship outcomes while enhancing those producers' livelihoods and the public benefits. So soil health and land stewardship truly matters. And why does it matter? So here's a map, right? And this, I think, try to put it in perspective of our population and our population increase. We look at this map, and you can see the DFW area in blue, right? There are more people in the DFW area than there are individually 37 states, right? So if this map doesn't catch you off guard, we're starting to put things of what we know of gaining 1,300 people moving to the state daily. All right? We're losing over 640 acres a day to development from our working lands and all of these that are providing. You know, these are true pressures that Gilly and other ranchers are facing, right, to keep our lands working. So land stewardship should matter to a growing urban public. We look at, you know, as I mentioned, we, you know, of the great work that Dr. Lopez has done on our land trends, and we're a very competitive state, extremely competitive, right? It's our ethos. It's part of us as Texans. And this is a race we're winning across the nation. We're losing more land than anywhere, than any other place in the country. And we're lapping people, right? And so we have to come together. We have to find solutions as we move forward to this. This is some work of the American Farmland Trust that just came out. And some of this is really looking at like forward looking from 2016 to 2040 of if we keep I think the top one, I can't see very well, is business as usual. So if we don't come up with solutions, we don't do anything, we're going to lose, you know, another over 2 million acres. If we have a runaway sprawl and not, which is highly likely, if we don't put policies in place and thinking of solutions, we're going to be pushing 3 million. If we think of better ways of trying to keep our lands intact, we can slow that process down to 1.3 million. And so, in essence, we're, you know, 73% of Texas conversion and 61%, this example of Tarrant County, is projected for the business as usual. So these are things, right? So these are things that are at stake that we have. We have, you know, over, you know, 140 acres of this agricultural land still remaining that we have to think about it. More importantly, beyond the acres is really those producers, right? We have six times as many producers over 65 than we do under 35. We're going to have the largest transfer of wealth in our nation in the next 5 years than we've ever seen, right? These are the things that we have moving forward. So perspectives matter, right? I think Mr. Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra, said it the best, right? I feel sorry for the people who don't drink, because when they wake up in the morning, that's as good as they're going to feel all day, right? So perspectives matter, and especially outside these walls, right, that have those disconnects, and how do we start doing it? But really it comes as those private land stewards are a part of the solution. They're the big part, the Garys out there in our state. And Aldo Leopold really said it the best, right? And conservation will ultimately boil down to rewarding the private landowners who conserve those public interests. So how do we start thinking what I call beyond the fence line? How do we start capitalizing, understanding all of those ecosystem services that flow off of those land stewards, off of those ranches, back to the community of clean water, clean air, open space, food, fiber, control of flooding, carbon storage. There's tons and tons of these ecosystem services as we start thinking about those goods and benefits that come forward. So we think of, again, taking the Dallas-Fort Worth example that I showed on the map, and I wanted to kind of provide is talking about the impact of those easements and talking about it from, so this is a Talt's story of we've conserved over 190,000 acre feet of water annually on those ranches that are scattered across the state. And that's enough drinking water to provide the town of DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth, for over 150 years, right? Those are the true impacts of the stewards and the lands that we're talking about and trying to find find answers and solutions to keep intact. My counterpart in California, the California Rangeland Trust, did a study on the values and return on investment of those conservation easements. They had around 250,000 acres that the project was looked upon in California, and they worked with Berkeley University with Dr. Lynn Hunsinger, who I've worked with for many years. And out of that 250,000 acres that were under conservation easements with the California Rangeland Trust, is providing over $1 billion worth of those ecosystem services back to the state of California, which is pretty amazing, right? When we start kind of thinking about the aspects and the benefits, the conservation values beyond just the appraisal is what Chris was talking about. And so I kept pushing my colleague and a friend that's around the table today, Dr. Lopez, is we called this report the California Report, and Roel and I would talk about this and the importance of our ecosystem services. And I told Roel, I'm tired of talking about the California Report. I'm ready for our Texas report. And so with that, Roel kind of took on the challenge. And I'm going to be able to just kind of give you just a highlight summary of this. And I'm hoping and keep pushing on Roel that this will be released here soon. And I would encourage everybody to have Roel kind of go deep dive into this valuation component. But this is why it's important, right? We're 83% rural working lands as we look at it. So we need to really start thinking about, which I appreciate Roel's aspect of thinking land as an infrastructure, right? And how do we capture that and utilize that, especially with our increased population? These are the reasons, right? And I already mentioned this, we're probably closer to 1,300 people a day. We're losing 640 acres a day, which I think in our next studies, we're going to be closer to 1,000 or over 1,000. Our pandemic is a kind of a double-edged sword. We had people during the pandemic that got closer to nature, understanding nature, but also realize, hey, we have broadband and things and internet. I don't have to live in Austin. I don't have to live in Houston. And that are some extra pressures back towards us in this situation. So our landscape is undergoing a rapid change because of these things. And we have to find some of these areas. So what are the values of the land, right, and those ecosystem services? And why are the value of the land important as we think about it? So land loss is highlighted in the red, right? Those are the areas that we're seeing more and more of those pressures and understanding the value of those ecosystem services. So quantifying the financial benefits and really informs us, right, from our decision-making, land policy, our conservation as we start kind of looking and having these dialogues and the importance of even what you guys are thinking on those projects to fund and move forward. So here's, we're able to basically, I think, believe 11 ecosystem services that we're able to actually put a dollar figure towards. A lot of this project was done on a kind of a proxy methodology where we looked at Natural Resource Conservation Service and the amount of funding that they did across the state and being able to look at what has been invested into these properties or, you know, for these ecosystem services. So if we really look at it from an average of the state, it's $629 per acre of ecosystem services is provided back to all Texans, right, on an average. One thing that I appreciate Roel in this work is that he's done this by a county basis. And we'll develop a tool that we can utilize this information, you know, and many other purposes. So Gary talked about today being a special day, and maybe this may hinder your special day, Gary, I don't know. But we're at 269 days of the year currently on September 27th, okay? And if we have at $629, right, and we think about how much we've lost, 640 acres a day, if we take that assumption, we've lost 172,000 acres so far today. And we times that by $629 per acre, as of today, this year, we've lost over $108 million one way to look at this, right? And the importance of what we're losing beyond just the land, but also all of these other factors. The other piece is from, you know, our mission at Talt, right? It's really conserving that heritage, that legacy, as Gary talked about it, of our natural resources, wildlife habitat. And Chris asked me to kind of talk about where we, you know, what's our projection? Where do we see our needs? And just working with the Garys across the state. When I came to Talt around 2.5 years ago, we had seven projects, seven families in the pipeline that we're working on towards a conservation easement. As today, we have 75, right? So the need is just, has gone, you know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And it's probably, you know, areas for us to think about. We're at 270,000 acres. We'll be over 300,000 acres by the end of the year. We have around 12 easements that we need to close by December 31st. And we will double in size in 3 years, no doubt. And if we were going to just do our pipeline and what we have today, which will keep growing, I could easily Talt, and that's just one land trust out of 30 plus in the state, I could spend $50 million every year for the near future. I mean, easily, from our analysis. And it's important when we start thinking about it. So what are the next tools, right? So conservation easements are a key. You know, we're working on how do we provide other values to the Garys across the country or across the state of ecosystem service markets, right, of carbon markets, but thinking beyond carbon, water, biodiversity, all of those ecosystem services that we're able to show in that report, there should be value to come back to those landowners to keep that. We have those conservation practices and the principles of implementing those practices, value-added markets, mitigation banks. Those are all tools, but really that's additive conservation. How do we start stacking all of these tools we have and actually put them in our conservation easement is the toolbox that holds those tools, right? It holds that for forever, and that's the key. And so with Gilly in the room, I had to kind of put some food for thought, right? Or other tools that we have or stake for thought, per se. So when we think about the beef community, which is, you know, our number one ag industry within the state, uses a technology that produces high-quality protein from solar energy. It's locked with human and edible plants. The technology produces natural organic fertilizer, is mobile without using fossil fuels, and the technology self-replicates. Right? So the technology is cattle and beef is the original plant-based meat, right? So I put that. We have lots of tools in the toolbox. And how do we utilize and suite of all these tools to move conservation and keep our working lands working and providing all of these services for all Texans? And really it's about shift in a strategy which is needed from a defensive to a proactive where we come together to address these challenges that we talked about, Chairman. It's really about keeping our working lands working and providing that legacy to the next generation. So with that, we'll go back to the very first question. I hope everybody has their wrote down how many of those water bottles Talt produces from those land stewards, those 38 family land stewards across the state. Anybody have a guess of how many of these those conservation easements are providing?
I do have a guess.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid it might be super crazy.
That's okay. Jump it out, Kim.
You said 270,000 acres.
Uh-huh.
So I'm guessing 500,000 maybe per acre. So I put 135 million.
Okay. Anybody else? I don't know if I should allow Roel. He knows the math.
I wrote down 125 billion.
125 billion, okay.
Makes
125
sense.
Billion? 5 billion? What's that?
500.
500 billion? You have how many?
5 billion.
Well, Chair, oh, yes, sir.
much, how do you know how much water it will produce if you've got various stratus
of water? Yeah, so a great question. So what we do from a science aspect, and we utilize Roel and his staff, is that we look at the rainfall, average rainfall within, you know, wherever that ranch is located, right, which is varies from across. And then we take about, you know, the science aspect that how much runs off, how much is infiltrated, and we utilize those aspects. So, Beaver, hats off to you, or cap to you, 516 billion water bottles.
16. And I get a cap?
You get a cap.
Man. Okay.
Maroon?
Of course.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Dr.
You were the next closest, so
that's what, I mean, that I can't end it at a better way of one, your guys' support and the pressures you have. All properties, all stewards are important, and it's how do we come together to keep providing that water and other to our community. So, again, appreciate everything you guys do. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Chad. That's the water is amazing statistics. The DFW, more population in 37 states. I don't know. That just struck you.
Quite shocking.
It did. It's striking, but I'm glad your group is working on the Texas model, not the California model, but I'm sure the California. And I'm sure that was helpful, but I'm thank you for the effort you're doing for that. That's good stuff, Chad. Members, any other discussions or questions for Chad? If not, item number 7, overview of the Northeast Texas Conservation Delivery Network. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing us to be here. This will be a bit of a change of pace, which may or may not be a good thing for you, but it is. I'm going to talk about, bouncing off Chad, some activity up in the northeast corner of the state that's been working now for a while to sharpen and organize and try to help distribute some of those tools in the toolbox, particularly with private landowners. So first things first, Bill Bardish and I are with the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture, what in the world is a bird habitat joint venture. So I'm going to give you just a brief explanation of what that is to know the context that we come from, and then we'll talk about Northeast Texas. It's essentially a group of folks voluntarily cooperating to focus bird habitat conservation to be more efficient and more effective. Who wouldn't want that? We have resources. We want to make sure we're good stewards of those. And also want to make sure that you know that we're one of 5 joint ventures, migratory bird joint venture partnerships in Texas. We've got the Gulf Coast, the Rio Grande, the Playa Lakes, the Oaks and Prairies, and then us there in Northeast Texas, the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture. All of the joint ventures are based on some basic premises about what we're about, but because of the different geographies, the different populations, the different challenges, we all approach things in slightly different ways. Fortunately, we're left to make our make decisions about how we approach conservation, but the underlying principles are all the same. So what do joint ventures do? Quickly, we organize the partners and take national, international bird conservation plans. There are plans for all the birds, all the groups of birds. We take that information and then we translate it into something that's relevant and reasonable and actionable in our own geographies, so that we have the basis for well-placed, effective, on-the-ground conservation actions, and all of that done through active partnership. The folks that are active in the joint venture are there because they want to be. They're there because they buy the premise and they buy the objectives. Matter of fact, they buy them because they're the ones that developed them. So we take this geography, which is the West Gulf Coastal Plains and Washita's for what it's worth, but it includes Northeast Texas, and we'll blow that up. And what you're looking at is one of a handful of priority maps. It's our open pine bird priorities. It's based on the science of what we think those priority species need, but it also has to be translated into action. It's just another book on the shelf, just another map to look at if something doesn't, something useful doesn't get done with it. And it's that translation into action that gets us to the Conservation Delivery Network. And so here you just see the geography of the Northeast Texas CDN. The CDN is not a map, it's actually people. There are now well over 15 organizations that participate in that network with 200 or so people that are actively involved in one way or the other, and most of those natural resource professionals were formally organized with a chair from the Texas A&M Forest Service, our co-chairs with Texas Parks and Wildlife, and our partnership coordinator, Bill Bartish, sitting right back here with the Joint Venture Office and employee of the American Bird Conservancy. That group developed a strategic plan and has developed spatial and functional priorities that help guide the work that we do. So why bother? Why would we worry about developing this network? Probably the one of the most important is to increase communication among delivery staff. The illustration that still works that I like to use is that our natural resource professionals are, for the most part, so busy with their heads down getting the job done that they rarely take much opportunity to look up and look around and see who's doing the same sort of things with them and around them. So increased communication. Because of that, if our heads are always down and we're not aware of what's going on around us, there's some opportunities that are lost, opportunities to share resources, opportunities to share information, that sort of thing. The CDN is a really good opportunity to provide a unified voice to potential funders and to landowners. And we talk a lot about our network of natural resource professionals being a one-stop shop. Regardless of which one of us a landowner talks to, they may as well be talking to the whole bunch of us. We're not just representing our own, whatever the logo is on our shirt. We're representing this community that has all sorts of different opportunities that landowners can and will utilize if they know about it. More focused, strategic, collective efforts. We talked about identifying priorities, and we'll show you some of those in just a second, both geographic and functional, where we've all agreed these are the most important things to do, and these are the most important places to do it so that we can focus resources where we think we're going to get the most bang for the buck. And ultimately, that increased resources that are dedicated to our conservation practices. And all of that meant to get bigger, better, measurable results. So talk a little bit about increased communication among delivery staff. The CDN's organized by basins to help encourage folks to plan and scheme and talk and share in close proximity with similar resource issues and challenges. We've conducted now numerous workshops, information sessions to make sure folks are up to date on the latest. Talk about more focused and strategic collective efforts. There's a ton of information, some of which our partnership has developed, some of which others have developed, taking that and focusing that in such a way that we're certain that the places that we're concentrating our resources are where we're going to get the best results. Certainly through that, having the most the highest probability of impacting wildlife the way that we would like also makes our being able to monitor and know that we've made a difference or not and adjust if we're not with the wildlife outcomes that we're looking for. And from a marketing what you do to funding opportunities, it demonstrates that we know what we're doing. And we've been successful at attracting support for the work because of that organization. One of the things that the storefront for our CDN is our Northeast Texas Habitat Incentive Program. This is a program that assists landowners in putting practices in place on their properties in those priority areas. It's just a summary of the success to date. By the end of this year, we'll be over $1 million spent since 2017 with well over 25,000 acres. We're at 20 now. Most of that in, try to read it there, sorry, in prescribed fire. That's the practice. That's the ingredient in natural processes that we feel like is most missing in Northeast Texas. So if you look at the scheme that I started with, what does a joint venture do in the first place? It sort of take these grand plans and then translate them into something that matters in your landscape, in our landscape, and we can turn that back around and say, well, now knowing the best things to do and the best places to do it, then we know how, where we fit in that scheme, and we feed back up into that larger picture of conserving habitats and conserving wildlife in our part of the world. We talk about bigger, better, measurable results. At the end of the day, we're most interested in wildlife resources. That's why we do what we do. But the fact of the matter is, getting that done is most dependent on people. And that is the network. That's the reason for the network. Bill likes to describe the Habitat Incentive Program as the gateway for many, many landowners, the invitation to participate in the kinds of land stewardship that they want, but they're not sure how to get. We can provide them some financial assistance and certainly lots of technical assistance to get that done and open the door for them into the wider world of all the things that are potentially available to them, and then work with them towards their goals and objectives. Again, that notion of making sure that landowners are aware of and have access to the full toolbox. So with that,
Dr. McKnight, thank you. Council members, any questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to action item number 8. I don't have anybody registered for public comment, but this would be the time if anybody would like to speak on matters within our jurisdiction, make it available. Okay, seeing none. Before we close up, anybody have any questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman, I was asked to get a picture of the Aggies for the Aggie magazine on this council. If we could just take a picture, if you're a former student, we could just stand up here and I'm going to submit it. They're asking for content for people that are appointed to statewide boards and things of that nature. So if we could take a picture, if you're an Aggie and you're willing to do that, if you could just stay for a few seconds after and take a picture.
Okay. We maybe should also offer, if you're a non-Aggie and someone would like to, you'd like to have your picture taken.
And be in our former students magazine.
Mr. Chairman, I would simply like to compliment you and Mr. Abernathy and staff on a very informative and inspiring session today. I appreciate it.
Especially hearing from the landowner, that was really impactful to see what we're doing.
Truly.
I think it could be very valuable if I can attend. I would love to, but that somehow you put a group together and go see Gary's ranch. I think he would love to show you. He's made an offer, and that was just, what a neat field trip to go see, you know, what you're doing, what you're accomplishing. That could be invaluable. So if you put that together, someone please let me know the date, and if I can attend, I will be there. Okay. Then I'm going to say that the council has completed its business, and I'm going to declare the meeting adjourned at 11:35 a.m.